Hallo Christoph.
Hallo Selin.
Und willkommen zu einer ganz speziellen Ausgabe von Treibhaus. Denn für einmal sprechen wir nicht über CO2-Bilanzen oder über schwindende Gletscher oder über Kipppunkte.
Nein, heute sprechen wir über Kunst. Und wir sprechen darüber, warum auch der künstlerische Diskurs und die künstlerische Praxis in der Klimadiskussion wichtig sind. In Treibhaus, dem Klimapodcast.
Mit Selin Elber.
Und Christoph Keller. Ja, wir fragen in dieser Episode, wie sieht so etwas aus wie künstlerisches Engagement gegen die Klimakrise? Welche Positionen können die Künste besetzen, wenn es darum geht, die Ursachen und Mechanismen der Klimakrise zu bezeichnen? Also ganz konkret, der Umgang mit der Natur, die Ausbeutung der Natur, die achtlose und respektlose Haltung gegenüber der lebenden Materie und den natürlichen Ressourcen und natürlich auch deren Kapitalisierung. Also was kann die Kunst hier leisten?
Ja, und welche Geschichten einer anderen Zukunft können uns die Künste erzählen? Sind sie vielleicht der Ort, wo Konzepte und neue Formen der Vergesellschaftung entworfen und ausprobiert werden können? Vielleicht auch sollen, gerade weil in den Künsten die Freiheiten groß und die Zugänge sehr divers sind, weil interdisziplinäres Denken und Handeln zu den Künsten gehören und weil der Raum der Kunst an sich einmal gesetzte Grenzen sprengt.
Nicht wir zwei führen diese Diskussion, du, Selin und ich, sondern wir bringen in dieser Ausgabe von Treibhaus den Mitschnitt einer sehr speziellen Diskussion, die am 15. November im Tanzhaus in Zürich stattgefunden hat.
Organisiert wurde der Anlass vom Klimakontor. Das Klimakontor versteht sich als eine Plattform für die Verbindung von darstellenden Künsten und der Klimagerechtigkeitsbewegung. Seit 2020 kuratiert es künstlerische Erfahrungs- und Vernetzungsräume für Kulturschaffende und Kulturinstitutionen, zivilgesellschaftliche AkteurInnen, Aktivismus und Forschung.
Ja, und gegründet wurde das Klimakontor von der Theaterfrau Barbara Ellenberger und der Schauspielerin und Dramaturgin Lucia Schelling. Seit letztem Jahr ist es in Händen der Kulturwissenschaftlerin Lena Schubert und dem Dramaturgen und Journalisten Johann Otten. Wir kennen sie beide gut, sie sind nämlich beide in der Treibhaus-Redaktion, sowie die dritte im Bunde ist Charlotte Mattheisen. Sie ist Tänzerin, Choreografin und Dramaturgin und zum Klimakontor gehört auch ein ganzes Netzwerk von KünstlerInnen.
Das Klimakontor also hat diesen Abend im Tanzhaus gestaltet und du warst ja mit dabei, Christoph. Wer hat denn da alles mitdiskutiert?
Ja, es gab zwei Kreise eigentlich in diesem Raum. In einem inneren Kreis saßen Katja Löpfe, sie ist Leiterin des Tanzhauses Zürich. Dann saß auch da Alexandra Gavilano, sie ist Umweltwissenschaftlerin und Klimaaktivistin. Als dritte saß da Isabel Wong, Kulturmanagerin, Kuratorin und Zukunftsforscherin, wobei sie wird da zu diesem Begriff noch etwas sagen. Und als vierte Lina Hasenfratz, Schauspielerin und Klimaaktivistin. Und eben die Moderation, die ist dann eben bei Charlotte Mattheisen, bei Lena Schubert und bei Johann Otten.
Und wie muss ich mir das Ganze vorstellen?
Es gab eben immer auch wieder Zuschauerinnen und Zuschauer, die sich in die Diskussion eingeschaltet haben. Die kamen dann so gewissermaßen in den inneren Kreis. Es stand da ein freier Stuhl, den Zuschauerinnen und Zuschauer besetzen konnten. Atmosphärisch war das so, dass wir in einem großen Saal saßen, der war etwas abgedunkelt. Etwa 50 sehr interessierte und aufmerksame Menschen haben da zugehört, und zwar etwa 2 Stunden lang. Es war also eine wirklich sehr aufmerksame und auch, ich würde sogar sagen, berührende Atmosphäre.
Das Ganze ging etwa 2 Stunden.
Genau, wie gesagt, es geht 2 Stunden und wir bringen die jetzt hier in Treibhaus, nicht ganz in voller Länge, aber beinahe. Wir bringen das hier sozusagen als Weihnachtsspecial, weil wir davon ausgehen, dass ihr ja über diese Tage viel und lange Zeit habt, um Podcast zu hören.
Vor allem auch lange Podcasts.
Eben sehr lange Podcasts. Und, muss ich ergänzen, Podcasts auf Englisch. Denn die Diskussion wurde im Tanzhaus Zürich auf Englisch geführt. Ja, und da ist sie also. Die Diskussion, die Debatte im Tanzhaus in Zürich am 15. November. Ich sage Vorhang auf.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for coming. It's really nice. We didn't know at all who is going to come and how many people are going to be there. So I'm very happy to see all your faces. So tonight is going to take about 2 hours and there will be no break. But we propose a relaxed setting for this evening. So the door will just be open. If you need to go out and come back in, just go ahead and do that. Also, if you want to change where you're sitting, if suddenly you're sitting in the second row and you're like, oh, I want to go front, you can always do that. You can, during the whole talk, join the circle. There is one free chair. If you feel the need that you want to engage in the conversation, if you want to ask questions or anything, really, we really would be happy. But there's also another option. If you want to just ask a question, I will pass this microphone to you. Just give me a sign and I will bring it to you, and you can ask your question from wherever you are. Hello. Tonight is recorded. We're doing an audio recording that will be made into a podcast later. And if you have a question that you want to ask and you don't want to be on the recording, just say it in the beginning and then we will cut you out. Okay? And then the last thing is that if you need any translation, if you want to ask in German or in Spanish or anything, you ask and I can help you to make it into English for you. Okay? I want to give a big, big thank you to the Tanzhaus for having us tonight, and also to the technicians that are working hard to make this all sound quite nice. And last but not least, to M2Act, who are funding tonight. And now I'm going to hand over to my colleagues, and I will be sitting here. If you have anything, just put up your hand.
Thank you so much, Charlotte. I also want to warmly welcome you to tonight's discussion. I hope everyone found a good seat and has a good view, and it sounds okay. I will briefly introduce you to us who organized this event. This is Charlotte Mathiesen, Lena Schubert, and me. I'm Johann Otten, losing a key. And we together form the network Klimakontur. This is a network that aims for linking art institutions, artistic practices with the climate justice initiatives and climate activism. And therefore, we are here and have this kind of talk. Because we are convinced that there's like a need to reflect on the role of art within the climate crisis, and as on a changing planet, also the like aims and purposes of the art is about to change, needs to change, and needs to be reflected. And this is the thing we try to do tonight. Or because we think that the responsibility of artistic practices is really to bring other images, other narratives of a just future to life, or to this kind of spaces. Or to put it differently, like on a planet that is exposed to extinction, we think that there's a need of rewilding thoughts to eventually like rewild the planet, as one of us put it very nicely in the briefing talk, but we come to that later. Was like having this as a bold purpose of the Klimakontur. I give the word to Lena, who will introduce all of you to the evening tonight, to the idea we have that we want to speak about, and it's you, Lena.
Yeah, but before I talk about the contents of tonight, I would like to introduce you to our guests. First, we have Katja Löpfe, the artistic director of Tanzhaus. Here we see Lina Hasenschratz, who is a climate activist and actor. Here is Isabel Wong, who is a curator and futurologist. And here is Alexandra Gavilano, who is an environmental scientist and also an activist. It's nice to have you all here. Now I will say a bit more about what we will talk about tonight. It's only a brief introduction, and we will have to talk about this in more detail later. But What we want to do tonight is that we want to expand the discussion on sustainability in the arts beyond a technical approach. And of course, it is very important that more and more artists and theaters shift to green electricity and vegan lunches. But still, we think that in order to address climate justice, we need a much deeper transformation in the arts. Perhaps we have to talk a bit more about what climate justice means. Climate justice is a perspective on climate change that understands it not as a technical problem, but as an ethical and political challenge. The idea behind that is that the climate crisis was caused by colonial and capitalist expansion, and that it has a disproportionate effect on those who are least responsible for it. So much about climate justice. I think it's clear now that this demands a much deeper shift in a society. And this, of course, also applies to the arts. We think that we need a shift in the very identity or the matter of art itself. And in detail, that means that we have to look at the role that art plays in society. We have to shift the narratives that speak through an artwork or performance. And we also have to question the self conception or the identities of artists and art institutions. All of that must be revisited within the framework of climate justice. And of course, this is a lot, and this is much more that we can than we can discuss tonight. So we had to narrow the frame for tonight, and we decided to focus on artistic autonomy, which is also known as artistic freedom. And we will hear much more how it connects to climate justice in the next 2 hours. But just to put it briefly, why did we focus on autonomy? Without a doubt, autonomy is one of the essential paradigms in the history of art. It has shape-shifted over time, that's important to say. But there still is a critical core that stayed. And that is the conviction that art and artists are free from social and from material dependencies. And also the idea that for a good artwork, the end justifies the means, however unecological these means may be. This, of course, has a history, a long history, otherwise it wouldn't be so powerful, probably. And historically, this concept builds on the paradigm of originality. It's connected to a craving for the new. It's connected to the frameworks of ownership and exploitation. And that's exactly where we see a link to the ideologies and practices that caused and that worsened the climate crisis. I think we all experience in the present moment how an ideology of an aggressive ideology of boundless freedoms often blocks the climate action that is so urgently needed. And that is not only outside of art, but that's also a problem inside of art, we believe. Yes, this is a very complex entanglement, and we will organize this a bit more tonight and also talk about perhaps some solutions or ways forward. But before we do that, Johan will say a bit more about the framework of tonight.
I will. I will briefly sketch this evening. So within our talk, we'll start by discovering like the concepts, the history of autonomy and freedom that you sketched already. Then we look at current practices and the artistic landscape in which those concepts are applied or are visible, and explore where there might be already other forms of autonomy or other thinking about the question of freedom. And finally, collectively journey into the possibilities of art to design other futures, just futures, or other images that tells us from other futures. And as also was summarized in the briefing, if like the 20th century was the century of freedom, perhaps the 21st century is going to be the one of responsibility. And this is perhaps also one of the main thoughts that are going to lead us through this evening. I want to just add a brief disclaimer. By discussing artistic autonomy and freedom, we discuss ideas that are expressed within the arts, and we don't question the freedom of expression or the right to resist against censorship. So this is really another topic, another matter. And finally, in this talk, we would wish to always talk from the perspective of own experience, of our own knowledge, and be aware of the privileges that we have, that we have such a kind of talk and such a kind of institution at all, which is really a privilege. And to bring also the idea in this round that we don't use generalizations and a form of accusations if we talk about specific practices or other forms of artist engagement, but rather practice a tolerance of ambiguity.
Yeah. Thank you, Johan, for providing the framework. I think before we start discussing, we have to learn a bit more about you, our guests here in the middle. Perhaps you could all introduce yourselves briefly and also tell us how freedom or autonomy in the arts speaks to you personally. And maybe, Isabel, you would like to start, and then we just go clockwise.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for the invitation. I'm Isabel Vuong, as you already said. Futurist is probably the term I really don't like, so I generally speak of a future specialist, for instance, or future researcher. And I don't know, I'm probably still a cultural worker and a curator, though that's pretty much open, I think, for me at the time. And as to the question of freedom, I would say that in a very general way, sometimes it's very difficult to address those terms in general, and I think that there's beyond the artistic field also a sense, a certain discourse that go with the idea that with climate change and environmental crisis, we're going to lose some of our freedoms, or this is one discourse, let's say. But when people speak in those terms, what do they mean with freedom? Probably they mean freedom of consuming or different things like these. And this is where it gets complicated, because I would want, and I tried in my life to have more freedom, for instance, in terms of time for my parents and for my families and for my friends and so on. So I think even the question of freedom, what do we mean with freedom? That would be my question as an answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel, and so good to meet you, and hi, everyone. Really happy to be here. I'm Ale, or Alexandra, she has preferred pronoun. And who am I? I always say I am many, and I'm nobody. I'm a manifestation of life, and I'm passed so quickly. So I'm here to dream, to manifest, but mainly to empower. So if you ever find me in another context, you will see, but last time she talked like in this art discussion, next time it might be a democracy rethinking workshop, and suddenly we'll be, you know, crash course on how bad is it actually and how much did shit already hit the fan. So just to say this as an introduction, I feel I'm a catalyst of just bringing people to the emerging and trying to help them to actually dream of where they think they can have the biggest impact. And I think there is also interesting to say, where does freedom come? What, just now when you were talking, I remembered that in the last 6 months, especially since February, since the last IPCC report, but I just remembered like, what would I do if there wouldn't be, you know, a planetary catastrophe? You know, what would I be doing? Where would I be? You know, what kind of things would I do? And I feel, because I'm now 33, so I'm since 15 an activist, and I dedicated my life to protect this planet. And we haven't moved that much in this last 18 years, I'd say. But I feel my freedom is limited due to the crisis. And still I feel I have more freedom as half Peruvian than my cousins and my family members have, that had a horrible time during COVID. So I feel free as a privileged person living in Switzerland, but I feel limited as a human being alive right now at this time. And at the same time, there is this emerging new understanding of freedom, because it actually really matters what we do or not do right now, if we act or don't act. So with that, I feel I landed in the point of time I'm meant to be, like we all did.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good evening. Hello, everybody. Nice that you're here. We didn't really expect so many people, I admit. That's great. So obviously we can move something by giving space. What am I? I'm overwhelmed by the topic, definitely, because I'm positionalizing myself in the fact to live in a bubble. I think that the art field is a bubble. We agree on certain values, we agree on a certain narrative, on a certain exchange and communication, and it's very easy to navigate through this bubble. But sometimes we forget about the outside, we forget about the surrounding, the environment, society as such. And there I question a bit the freedom of artists or the art, also in terms of wondering what happened in the last few years, maybe also even more after COVID. We said we don't want to criticize. I do it a bit because I think that sometimes for me art stays very much self-defined, very much in their own sumpf, very much busy with their own subjects. And I can swear I see so many art pieces or dance and theater pieces, and I admit that very often I'm not touched. I'm left out somehow. And so is society in the topic. I think it's too much about ourselves and about our little worries and themes. And I think that we have to face kind of a white privilege, maybe, or a Western privilege rather, that we can afford to go this way, because I think there are other realities that are facing a different reality and a different challenge also. And that's something that's bothering me, or that is keeping me alive also, because I think we have to say much more than what I experience sometimes. I think the art should come out of the shadow and speak up.
Thanks. Also, hello from me. My name is Lina, and as mentioned, I'm actress and climate activist. Actually, the biggest project or the longest I've been doing was a play where I was playing a climate striker, a climate activist. So that was like a combination of what I was working at this point and what I was doing in my free time. My thoughts on autonomy and freedom of arts, I mean, freedom and autonomy, these are so positive words. I would always say that I'm pro-freedom and pro-autonomy. But I find it really important to say that freedom should go, or the possibilities that you have should not go too far. I think there's this saying that someone's freedom only should go as far as it does not hurt or limit or restrict the freedom of someone else. And I think we should really think of that in a way of, as you said, responsibility. I always admired that art has this freedom, but I think I meant the content of art, like being able to criticize and so on. But I then, when I started working in this field with theater, I realized that there's not so much freedom when it comes to structures. So we live in this capitalistic system and art institutions are part of it. And it's really difficult to change something within the structures of working like the working times and so on, the pressure that you have also financially. So I'm really happy to talk about this with you this evening.
Yeah, thank you so much for all the intros. I mean, we have a lot of things in the round already. We would love to now start like the first part of the discussion, but first of all, again, pointing to this little chair that everyone is invited to join a conversation all the time if you want to, if you feel free to join and add something that you feel is missing. So don't hesitate to come to us. But we want to jump in the first round of discussions right now, and this round is the round where we kind of go in the background, in the history, in the heritage of freedoms that we carry in those institutions and in our artistic practices. And I would love to start asking you first, if you could answer the question, how come that that freedom is so inherently linked to art? Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, so somehow I found myself as a futurist having to talk about the past, but this also very much makes sense in the sense that stories of the future always start in the past, go over the present, and end in the future. So there's always a link, of course, between the past and the future. And some in future studies would even make the case that future studies is not so different than history, you know? That is based on traces and providing or being able to have, or where it's about interpretations and interpretations changing with time. We have some dramatic example of the past being interpreted with the Putin war at the time. So definitely the past is also playing out in the present, just as the future is also playing out in the present, is performing constantly in the present, actually. I often say, indeed, that if the 20th century was the century of freedom, of hard-won freedoms, and we would perhaps, or I think, often of the civil rights, but actually I should go back to perhaps the end or some kind of form of end of monarchy, and authoritarianism, and this is when probably I need to say that I'm speaking from an Eurocentric or perhaps even Western Eurocentric perspective. But nevertheless, if the 20th century was perhaps the century of hard-won freedoms, we could also hope that the 21st century would be the century of responsibility. And if I find this proposal interesting as to the topic tonight, is because of for different reasons. Perhaps the first one being that as long as we speak of artistic freedom, of course we're going to oppose it to restrictions, limitations, things that are not possible to do. Whereas, of course, if we change the paradigm to artistic responsibility, the terms of the discourse don't pose themselves, are not posed in the same way, right? And as a futurist, I see, and I'm also doing the same, of course, but we always, as we're trying and we see the urgency and the need to bring about a different world, to have something new emerge, we actually very often speak still in the terms of the old world. And probably this is the leap that we have to do, that is we have to change the paradigm, that is the very terms with which we see, we perceive reality in order for this new world to emerge. And also I have the chance, thanks to Nadia Baldini, who didn't want it to be pointed to, who is there, I had the chance to collaborate with her on a publication on art in the public space, and on that occasion I dwelled a bit on historical paradigms in the arts, and we found out that artistic freedom and avant-gardes were born themselves after Second World War, on the basis of indeed art being entangled with propaganda. So artistic freedom was also part of those hardly won freedoms, and very necessary in that sense. So, and you've been talking, Katya, about self-referentiality. And indeed, the first paradigm that came after Second World War was that of excellence. So there was the idea that avant-garde would be able to be self-referential, that is, indeed not being used as propaganda or being referred to external political demands. So it was indeed a hard fight, but it was always in contrast with the context. So this brings us back to the idea that the future is always a story that starts with the past, goes over the present, and ends in the future. It's never separated from the past. I wanted to say something else, but now I don't remember. So I will pass on, perhaps, the word.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, thank you. What could be added, or what was interesting for me, is perhaps if you could elaborate a bit on the idea of the individual, because I think this is also something that is inherently linked to the concept of freedom within the arts, as far as I understand it, but you don't need to do that. And we could also speak about that, because I think I would love to know how the concept of freedom that is based in the past contributed to the climate crisis, but I think therefore we should talk about the idea of the individual or the individualistic approach that is inherently linked in a lot of narratives within the arts, or are like in the propaganda, or like are being brought on stages. Perhaps this is something you could add a thought on.
Well, there's another thing that I say when I talk about this 20th century, 21st century, and this probably links also to that, because when I hear you, I can't help thinking about the opposition between, in the 20th century, between communism and neoliberalism. So I think Westerners had a sense that neoliberalism, that is the individualistic trend, kind of, so to say, won over the other. But I think that the main learning of the 20th century is perhaps that ideologies of any kind are the problem. And we indeed now see that individualism only brings us so far. But again, probably it was also born on the background of propaganda, collectivism, and so on and so forth. Now, perhaps in the performing arts, in specifically, it's very interesting because it's a collective art also. But there's still this authorship, this notion of individual authorship. But at the same time, I feel, as far as the dance field is concerned, that there's been work being done in that in the direction of having more collective authorship and so on. I'm looking to.
Yeah, I think, but that changed not so long ago. I think we also faced very hierarchic ways of working, and I agree. I think that the situation we have now, it was also influenced by this notion of freedom and the way we were acting. I would not be able to state it at a certain moment in history, but it was kind of the feeling of now, freedom of art, we can do anything goes attitude, first of all. And there was no reflection about what does it mean? What do we do? I'm always a bit contextualizing because we are only a small field, and it's not a big, I mean, we know all that the big companies are polluting the world much more, but I think that's exactly where we start, that we have the power or the skills to really go into a mind change or a mind shift also. I think that's feasible. But I see certain attitudes like past, I hope, that yeah, we need to, like in a hamster wheel, we need to produce every 2 months a new piece, and we need to be visible, and we need to have the attention from everybody, and we need to tour, and if you're not touring, then we are gone, and if I don't apply next year, they will forget about me. So this is exactly a very neoliberal way of thinking, actually, even if we pretended always that we are absolutely not that kind. So it's a bit a hidden, strange thing, I find.
I am also always saying that, I'm even saying that actually climate change is not about CO2 emissions, and that if we work climate change or sustainability exclusively through CO2 emissions, that is in the art reducing flying, reducing material production, actually these are only symptoms or consequences of these project-based systems that have artists, constrain artists into accumulating dates and so on. And this is perhaps indeed what is unsustainable, basically, is the pressure to produce. So rather than, and then flying being only the symptom of that, but not the origin of the problem. And if you address climate change through CO2 emissions, you address it to the most visible, through the most visible consequences of our ways of living, our economic systems, but also our values in productivism, etc., etc. So that joins back.
Thank you both. Like, not being from the field, it's really interesting because it gives these new angles. But I would just like to invite to go also a jump back, because when we look at it historically, I mean, what do we also have in our Swiss museums, right? It's like art or cultural art that are definitely not coming from this continent, and they're still here, and nobody's going to the street to demand, hey, the real origin of these pieces should be recognized and given back. You know, there is some reparation work to going on. And if we look at kind of this art that we see in the museum, that there's still money done, so I would say it has already started with colonialism. Maybe even if we would go further back, we would see patterns of that, which is definitely the expression also of what you have been talking about. But I would also say, and here making the link to the individual, so I believe it is, on the one hand, the egoistic neoliberal approach of I can use everything and I have the right to do it. So with being without boundaries, which we see also outside of art, so I'm talking here on a general level, like the use and abuse of nature and other humans. Also, the disconnect of us understanding ourselves as nature, that I feel led to that, because it made it easier to then justify destruction, because it means I don't hurt myself or my beloved ones. But then also looking, and I think here is the Western Eurocentric, but also, I mean, the United States obviously are also part of that, that then flowed into it to kind of who are the people that actually could live from their art. You know, maybe now it's more than it used to be, but those that could live from it were people in very highly privileged situations, that maybe some of them did everything themselves, some of them may not. And those images that we still go to look, so I'm just referring here to Louvre, the big museums, until now, they're paid by the fossil fuel industry. I mean, tomato soup against the painting has more than just it's a tomato soup against the painting. It means no sunflowers will be here to look at that you will paint, but also why should this be protected by industry, and we should just pretend that it's okay, you know, to justify art and the maintenance and access of art by the companies that actually are destroying it. The art that has been built on the nature or being inspired by nature surrounding it. So I feel what maybe has happened in that way is that through maybe the focus on the individual, you know, way, pathway, which I really believe it's not just art, we see it in all parts of society, led that this big mega industries that nobody identifies. I don't know anybody who says, I feel like the fossil fuel industry, I identify as such. So we have this human-based structures that kind of we want to give them all the fault, but we are still consuming it. And say, yeah, well, but that, this is justified. And I think this is what led to that very much our individual actions, even if we're far away and we're super recyclers and have super consciousness and maybe go to a demo, if our goal is still to be part of that system that is supported on the pillars, on the financial pillars of those industries that nobody wants to talk about, we are part of the problem. So I think there it's also, I feel like a liberation movement that can also come of who do we want to be associated with? Who do we invite in our circle of free artists, right? Or what are our values and until which layers should they go, maybe beyond the bubble that you were referring to look who is the building we're standing on, whose land was it, who else was doing the work to actually heal, so we can, and what you said, go to dreams in the future. So yeah, that's my bit on it.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting is that on the one hand we're talking about a lack of something, which would be perhaps a lack of time, and also perhaps a problem of distribution of money. And on the other hand, the resources that we can have are very often tied to companies like fossil fuel companies. And the interesting thing is that we're seeing, I think, a lot of activists turning at these art institutions these days. So I think we see how many artists use their freedom to actively criticize the structures of established institutions, just like the activists who are throwing potato stuff at paintings these days. And I think for many in the circle, there does not seem to be so much conflict between the artistic identity and maybe also the activist identity. And Lina, because I wanted to ask you, because you have been working as a climate activist, but also as a stage performer for a long time, how did these identities come together in your biography? Was there a conflict ever between these identities?
I mean, of course, they're not the same identity. I mean, when I was, for example, part of the play where I was playing a climate striker, I always had to... Yeah, I mean, I always realized, okay, I'm acting, I'm playing the character of a climate striker. It's not the same when I'm being a climate striker. But I really like how these two things came together. Because for me, art and activism is so close. You see it in the forms of actions. We have flash mobs, like dances. You have art, like paintings on the streets or graffitis. For me, these two always have worked together. And I also loved the fact that a lot of people within the art industry are completely agreeing in the point that we have to change something when it comes to the future. I mean, yeah, sometimes... I don't know what I was about to say. Could you repeat the question, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, about the conflict between your perhaps activist identity and your artist identity. But
I mean, becoming part of the artist industry is a bit difficult because you have to adapt to a lot of things. You have to, at the beginning, I personally feel like I have to adapt to a lot of things to become part of it. And sometimes that goes against some of the things that I feel like I stand for. But maybe that's something I need to learn to live with. That, I mean, as with everything in life, also when it comes to sustainability, I'm not perfect. And maybe I also have to live with these facts that sometimes what I do as an artist does not perfectly combine being an activist. But I try my best to combine these two and have also an activist view in being an actress.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I mean, perhaps, would you like to answer?
I would have a question. Perhaps it's intrusive, but you don't answer. But would you have an example of those dilemmas, perhaps, or those conflicts that you have, if it's not too much to ask?
I mean, for example, I did an internship at an art institution. And when you're doing an internship, you have, honestly, you don't have much to say. You don't have any power to change anything. So then the question is, okay, do you want to be the annoying person always getting on everyone's nerve? Or do you want to use that chance to get into art industry and then maybe at one point when you have more chances to change something there? But at the same time, I mean, I want to criticize the fact that as an intern, you have nothing to say. I also criticize the way power is distributed at institutions. But I guess I have to play my role in this industry as long as I don't have the power to change it.
Mm. I think that's something that is a very profound problem in climate activism these days, because many of the activists are very young and they're not yet, in positions of power. So it's very often always a question of how to, what are the privileges that I have that I can use, and where am I so, like, on the, the bottom of the ladder that I can't really push against it. So what is my freedom to act against the structures? And I wonder, as a person who's the artistic director of an institution, how do you address this kind of hierarchies? Okay, I don't want to put you on the spot.
It came by surprise.
I will answer this in a second. I was just triggered by what you said, and I thought that quite interesting. Because, I thought it's so intimate here. You will hear me anyway, but okay, we need to record. So I was just thinking that actually activists, in relation to the society, you exaggerate totally. I mean, you do a little small something much bigger than everybody else in society. And same for actors. I mean, the same could be artists. And so I see this you have in common. And I was, I mean, somebody opened my eyes a bit during our meeting there in Gessenrallee about 2 years ago, I don't know, because an activist told us, hey, come on, you art people, you always talk about being in front of society and being utopist and the avant-garde, etc. But where are you? I mean, we need to change the world. Where do I see you? Come on, get out of your institutions. I loved it. I thought that's great. We should really cooperate much more. Concerning hierarchy, I was just thinking, yeah, that's maybe exactly the problem, that people not in power don't dare to break this rule. Because I swear, once you try to do so, the outcome is much more interesting. So if you listen to the voices of the many, because everybody, even the stagiaire, has an experience, an expertise, a life that she or he lived already, and everybody can contribute to making something diverse, better, you name it. And so I deeply believe in, I mean, we have people here from the house, so you can also add, but I deeply believe in super flat, more than flat hierarchy, if this is possible. Of course you have, I mean, there's also, of course I'm on the paper kind of responsible for the whole house, and they would chop my head off if we have a huge deficit, but it's not about that. I mean, it's really about collaboration and how to collaborate together and understanding ourselves as a big body and not single people. And that the result is always made and designed by all these experiences we put into it. And I think the result is much more interesting, much more powerful, much fairer, much more interesting, it's also motivating much more. And then the best would be then that people have the freedom, I reuse the word in a different context, have the freedom to take their time to think about what is really relevant in my life. Could I not contribute to making this world a bit better? And that's for sure also concerning climate change or climate justice. So if you're constantly busy with some little small things or trying to survive and or being sick also, I mean, it's also about privilege again. But if we all manage to kind of support each other and to care for each other, and everybody has a bit more air to breathe, to really have time and capacity to do something, that helps already, I think.
Mm-hmm. Again, the topic of time and capacity. I'm wondering, because there's many people in the audience who may also personalize at the same time an activist identity or understand or identify as activists in one way or another and also as artists. So maybe if there's someone who would like to speak from their experience and come here, we're very happy if someone is so brave. Yeah, you would. Yeah, thank you. And please also introduce yourself briefly. That would be wonderful.
I just first have to try if I'm okay with speaking through a microphone because sometimes it confuses me a lot.
Otherwise, we do without. Okay.
Okay. Let's try. If I hear myself double, I cannot think anymore. That's a bit of the problem. So, yes, my name is Marie. I'm a choreographer and currently researching on plastic. Mm-hmm. And I wanted also to share something before I answer your question, to share a thought that I had before in the speak of autonomy. I wrote down plastic autonomy. In the thoughts that I'm developing about plastic, I found out what plastic actually means for human beings, which is a lot about separating ourselves from everything around us. So protecting, conserving, separating, keeping dry, keeping wet, everything. So not allowing the natural development to actually take place. And I was thinking along the line of, yeah, maybe some understanding of artistic freedom or autonomy could be put into this word of plastic autonomy, like not permeable anymore. Does it make sense?
Totally. Totally. Thank you.
And then to share some thoughts about understanding myself as an artist or an activist. I think it's two very different languages and very different means. I know that we could probably use artistic means for activism, but I actually do believe that we can reach different levels. I think both are needed. There is, for one thing, there are like words is one language, of course, that can be refined. And for me, art is also a language that reaches other regions, other ears. And it also has to be refined. So for me, also, I was listening to Katya speaking of projects that or artistic productions that don't touch you. For me, these are also legitimate because they can also serve to develop a language that can be used to say something later on. Somehow, that's always how I see it. So we need to actually learn how to speak. We need to develop a vocabulary before we can say something meaningful. But then again, for me, it's always very important to contextualize, like, what do I want to say to whom, how, and which level do I want to be understood in? This means that, if I have a very clear message, I will most probably use words and not art. And if I want to reach layers that are much less tangible, that are more intuitive, that reach more, like, for example, dance is really the art of the body in space. It's a lot about relationship, like where do I stand as a body, as a human body, breathing, living, experiencing, seeing, sensing, how do I relate to my environment? And there's for me the potential of dance. But this reaches other levels, other regions, as words could. I think both are important. Mm. So I do believe that artists and activists have to kind of collaborate for sure, work hand in hand for sure, go out of the theaters for sure. But protected spaces of art reaching other regions of our brains are also important for me, like to be conserved in a way.
Thank you very much for contributing this perspective. You can also stay if you like. Feel free. Yeah.
You can send me away if it's enough.
No, please stay. We can also add more chairs in the circle. Totally I'm not sure. Yeah, come. I mean, come. I don't know. Come closer. No, I wanted to ask you because I know that in your climate activism, you're also using creative methods and performative methods. And because you said it's different languages, and you discriminate between the languages depending on the target or the person that you want to address. So you make a difference between you choose. That's what I want to say. So. When do you use performative or creative methods in your climate activism? Who's your audience then? What's your target then?
Well, thanks for the question. I think it really depends. So I think where does it emerge? So let's say 2015, I was at the COP21, and we had very simple, you know, performances, flash mob style in the blue zone, so where all the decisions are done. With the 1.5 degrees demand, with the Pacific Island activists that were on site. So at that point, you had a very simple kind of mirror of what is actually happening to those people trying to transmit it. Now we're 2022 and it has changed completely. So you find what we call artivists, so artists that identify as activists, in all kinds of forms and shapes and in expressions, and it really also depends where you are. So I wouldn't say it's one audience that you would target, but it depends what is it for, where does it happen, and in which form. So I really liked what you say, it's for different ears or ways of actually sensing and then presencing what is really here. So I think one part is, and I just want to build upon what you said, is for me, my dream is that we kind of save the planet, and at some point I can say I'm not an activist, I have been one, but now I do other things. So for me, to be an activist shouldn't be an identity. Like, it is something that comes that I have to step into acting, basically here a little word game, right? But I have to act to change something because I cannot accept what the status quo is, while art in itself should always exist, and it can... Maybe at some point now we're in how can it get responsible, or how does it maybe change, or where is the invitation to use the art in all its diversity to actually help to mobilize more. So I think there is where we're going to, and where I would say maybe in, let's say, 30 years from now, art can then be more on regeneration, adaptation, you know, other things that might now not be in the focus, or maybe it's also like able again to, you know, evolve in its own bubble or in new bubbles, whatever. But I believe, for example, taking art in the comparison of what happens here in Switzerland or in Europe to what happens in other countries, I just explained before, we had last week a Memorial Day of Ken Saro-Wiwa. He was an artivist in Niger Delta, where Shell is basically, you know, extracting a lot of oil. 200 new licenses are currently being held. Swiss banks are heavily involved. The cars we're driving are from that region to the big part. So he was an artivist fighting against it, mobilizing 300,000 indigenous people of the Ogoni tribe in that region. And he achieved that protesters, up to 1,000 protesters were arrested, where it finally ended in 1995, that he and 8 others, indigenous artivists, so all working with art, were killed. And they were basically killed by Shell, even though we have no tribunal, even though in Switzerland nobody ever made a shout out. So their art was something in a very, let's say, he painted, he made a sculpture, so they had songs. So on a very simple way of just trying to take to people, it's not okay, you know, Shell, go to hell. So there it's something, maybe elements you would also see here on the street, and you might say, yeah, but this is just too general. Where there it led for them being killed and status quo going on until nowadays. When we're here, for example, in Switzerland, we can use art in this way as demonstrations, making it more inclusive, you know, talking to other people, creating nice images. But I believe art could even be more. So if you want to come out of the house at some point, or you're already anyway doing it, so I don't want to imply that, but just sending out an invitation to your direction. I mean, what I dream of is like a huge blockage, let's say Highway A1, And it starts with a beautiful orchestra, you know, playing Vivaldi, like the Four Seasons. And then ballet dancers come, right? And then, you know, you have like 3D graffiti artists painting the crisis, the people on the floor, the people actually think, oh, I shouldn't step here. Oh, no, it's just painted. So, you know, I imagine there that art could help so much that we are not just labeled as, oh, these are the activists. Because everyone's saying it's young activists. It's so not true. Mm. Like, it's really not true. I mean, we have lawyers helping us. We have medical people helping us. We have parents and grandparents of people getting arrested, gluing themselves to the floor, or just cooking in the kitchen, you know, so or taking care of the kids. So it's not the just the youth, but I feel a lot of times, so please correct me, but it's still labeled, oh, these are just the youth, the radicals. Mm. And I think art could really help to transform this image, because suddenly they say, hey, wait, I paid like 100 francs to see that person, and now they're just doing it on the street. Oh, that's some kind of sympathetic, you know? I like that. So it's really kind of enabling the wider society to also see, hey, it's about all of us and about all of them that have no voices, animals, and plants. So for me, it is really kind of a catalyzer that in its diversity could help to get so many more people. And I think that's why also the movements in the last 2-3 years started to use art, because they realized we need other languages, because if we just get arrested or if we just demonstrate or squat places, we are not able to show the society that we're all Homo sapiens and we need everyone.
I think what...
Sorry. No, I just wanted to say I completely agree with that. And as I mentioned before, as an activist, I usually feel like I'm getting on people's nerves when I'm trying to inform them about climate crisis, for example. And then as an artist, then I see it as my job and I feel like, okay, that's the audience and they're here to see that and to get informed, for example, about the climate crisis through art. So as mentioned, I also see that there's a huge potential in art helping us getting our demands. And also, I think what's also beautiful about art is it doesn't always have to be so concrete. We are always struggling with finding concrete demands because we feel like, okay, to accomplish something, we need to tell people we need this and that. And with art, you can raise questions, you can make people feel emotions, and you don't always have to see that in a very political way of having to answer questions with yes and no.
And I want to also connect back to you, because I feel like even if I said before it's different languages, again, here I'm not talking about plastic autonomy. Like, it's super important that there are collaborations happening, there is dialogue happening. I also feel it's important also the other way around. Like, artists and teams bringing in activists or specialists while working on certain topics. I feel this is super important. And of course, I mean, I don't know about ballet, but if you ever need a choreographer for A1, I mean.
Yeah, what just is happening, I think it's so interesting. We just went to the practices. We really embraced the practices of what is to be done. And I think what I really would love to know from you, Katja, perhaps, is because you were talking about that you're not touched by pieces, or you're not touched by things. And I think this is perhaps also linked to the idea of autonomy and the independent art, because we are now just talking about dependency and stories of being dependent on resources, being dependent on nature and on, like, on the planet. Perhaps you could elaborate a bit on what are the stories that need to be told in art institutions or from artists that are touching you, or that are perhaps telling different stories that deal with this heritage of autonomy.
I very much long for stories that are connected with me, that are connected with the civil society, that are connected with nature, with all the topics we have around us. I always feel a bit like that. I mean, this sounds now very much SVP-like, but the tax money that is going into a huge production, like
and the people are rehearsing for 2 months. Just that I witness a piece of 1 hour talking about the inner self in relation with the space and whatever. So that might be very interesting as a research or as a, well, for the person on stage, that must have been great for 2 months. But I'm there and it stops right. I mean, I'm sitting there and it stays here somewhere. And really, I don't need, I mean, I'm not talking about narratives that tell me a story from A to Z, but I need, be it through music, be it through movement, be it through text, I need some kind of a story that elaborate, that erases pictures, images, fantasies in myself, that I'm touched somehow. And then maybe it is about climate justice, maybe it is about gender, maybe it is about equity or about positionality, whatever. I very much feel it when it happens. It's much harder to talk about what it needs exactly. But there comes the body back, and I'm totally thrilled by all these ideas, because I'm saying yes, yes, yes to this collective movement, or when a lot of bodies move together, that's just something that is just amazing, and it moves the world, let's say. I think, well, be it ballet dancers or whoever, also people, that's really something I deeply believe in, because it reaches us on a different level. And maybe, yes, if you want to say something very clear, you use words, because we are a word-based society. But if you want to go beyond and teach people, not teach, that's very pedagogical, but if you want to find out things that you don't know yet, where you are landing maybe afterwards, you use your body. Fuck's sake.
So, you have a question. Sorry.
Can I ask a question real quick? Do you have any examples of something that did touch you lately?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of examples that touch me. There, well, I could now talk about pieces which I don't find right. I would rather like to talk about an experience that touches me, that is always when, of course, there is music and bodies and kind of a mutual understanding among those people. So it's hard to say what it is exactly. What I can say is that sometimes we, in Tanzhaus, we decided to use choreography and dance skills to learn more about each other or to work with each other. Maybe I'd rather bring this example, that we experienced really kind of a revolution in our working, the daily business, working in front of a computer. Whenever we did 1 hour of warm-up or dance practice with certain tasks this choreographer gave us, it's Monica Gillette, by the way, she's great. She did that with us also during pandemic, and I swear, after this hour, we were different people. We were working with each other in a different way. I was answering my emails in a different way. We had another understanding of conflicts, another understanding of listening, another understanding of how to communicate with each other. Maybe I would rather take this example, because that moved me a lot, that this is happening and this is possible, and I think we could use that in other fields. Really. I
wanted to add something.
So perhaps I would have a rhetorical question. So now that we've been seeing the proximities, or the possible proximities and potential, the enormous potential for art to be perhaps closer to activism, then of course I need to ask, since environmental activism has started at least with the atom, how do you say that in English?
Nuclear.
The nuclear protest, thank you. So it means about 60 years ago, why didn't we have artistic activism? Why is not art at the front of environmental activism? And I want to go back to what you've been saying as your experience, for instance, as a practicant, as a voluntary work, as a...
Internship,
yeah. Thank you. Because I think that speaking out, the impossibility to speak out is not only the case when you are in those very low position. And throughout my experience in the cultural field and very difficult experiences where I couldn't speak out, there's a text of Sahra Ahmed from a book that's called Living a Feminist Life, which was somehow a lifeline in those moments. And I want to read some of it. It's going to be short. Audre Lorde once wrote, "Your silence will not protect you, but your silence could protect them. And by them, I mean those who are violent or those who benefit in some ways from silence about violence." I switched to a few sentences afterwards. So. Over time, the time of being a feminist, we might call this feminist time, I have to come to understand, to know and to feel the costs of speaking out. I have thus come to understand, to know and to feel why many do not speak out. There is a lot to lose, a lot, a life even. So much injustice is reproduced by silence, not because people do not recognize injustice, but because they do recognize it. They also recognize the consequences of identifying injustice, which might not be consequences they can live with. It might be fear of losing your job and knowing you need that job to support those you care for. It might be concern about losing connections that matter, concern that what you say will be taken the wrong way, concern that by saying something, you would make something worse. And then she goes on saying that even if speaking out is not possible, it is necessary. And if I pursue the idea of this excellence paradigm being self-referential, I think that the art field is not only a bubble in terms of we know each other, it's cool, and so on. I think that there are lots of codes and lots of things that are untold and that we can't say. And I would relate, as far as I'm concerned, this to sometimes an incapacity to speak out, and also the reason why we don't see more art activism. And I would even say, just as I said before, people will say freedom of consuming, whereas they are, or we could perhaps say they are perhaps slaved of consuming. And we talk about artistic freedom. Isn't that perhaps also precisely because there is little artistic freedom on certain aspects? That would be my question.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, we have someone new and around. And perhaps it's very good to let this stay in the air as an open question. Do you want to add something? Or you came to us with a question?
Hello. Yes, with pleasure. Thank you very much. My name is Srikant. I'm a writer. And maybe just a couple of points. So I think that, you know, climate change has in the past influenced art. You know, if you're familiar with the example of the Netherlands, because of the changing fish patterns, they had more fishes close to them. That's why they became very rich. And that's why we first had Western art, you know, secular movements, right? So I think we should return the favor, and artists should also do something about climate change. And now it comes to the question of belief, right? If you go to Prague, there's a Museum of Communism, and it's famously in the McDonald's, above the McDonald's. It's a joke they keep making. And there's this line which says that communism is the one philosophy which has led to the deaths of so and so millions of people, right? And I think that everyone who was involved in that, in the various events related to that phenomena, wasn't necessarily a scholar of Karl Marx, who wrote a lot of words and lots of texts and did lots of empirical research. So I suspect that there was some amount of belief in there, faith in there as well. Mm-hmm. And it's similar to what happened in Brexit, if you're familiar with the debate just in 2016. A senior government official actually said, I quote, people in this country have had enough of experts. And I think, unquote, and I think that's really important. It sort of suggests that there has been a certain contempt with which people who are experts, perhaps because they're exasperated, that no one understands that heating is taking place. But the point I'm trying to make is that a lot of the people who are protesting about whatever, various things may not necessarily have all the information to make and easily be able to prove the science behind what they're talking about. So there is an element of faith and belief, I suppose, but I'm willing to be challenged on that. And I think that art is therefore an excellent way of making that pitch, because art is also not about being very, very specific. If you look at Delacroix, Liberty Leading the People, he doesn't actually say, here is liberty and here are the people. He actually paints it, and then you need to relate it to yourself, right? And then the last point I'd like to make is that someone said that about the point about languages, right? Different words for different kinds of audiences, right? And of course, advertisers know this very well. So if they want to sell you woolen socks, there's going to be the scene where, I don't know, a woman, maternal figure looks, very concernedly at a child, and then, you know, there's a certain sound in the background. And so that's been done, you know, in a harmless way, but it's been done in a very nasty way by the Weimar Republic, by the Soviet state, and so on, right? But after Josef Beuys, I think we are all artists, so I don't think we need to have a degree in art. We also don't need to have a degree in activism. I think we all should be also activists, presumably, which also means that there's probably lots of bad art, right? I've been to lots of theater productions where I couldn't wait for the break so I could leave that room. And here's the point I'm trying to make with all of this, is that maybe art doesn't need to be good. Maybe it doesn't need to be high quality in this point of urgent action. And maybe that's exactly another point where artists and activists can come together. And the thing you mentioned about the highway, maybe it doesn't need to be choreographed in advance with lots of training. Maybe it can just be the people whose cars have been stopped and they can join the dance. So yeah, that's just a perspective I'd like to share. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's perhaps the third paradigm. That is, the first paradigm is excellence. The second one is cultural democratization. It's a bit a la Jacques Lang. That is culture, but we try to do mediation and to make it accessible. And then the third moment, cultural democracy, would be rather that there are different culture. Everybody's doing culture in its own way. Mm-hmm.
Good summary. Love it. Thanks a lot, one, for your input, but also what you have shared. Feel free to go back if you want, but it's still you're also invited to stay. Yeah,
we can add chairs to the circle.
So one thing I really loved is from the text that you read, and I don't know this text from this book, but obviously, I mean, it's one thing that has been hanging around since forever. So if you're silent, you're part of the problem. And this is where we are right now, which I would say 10 years ago, it was not the case, right? So this is also linking to what you have shared, right? Is it really that we need knowledge now? I think now we're at the point of and I would even call it climate catastrophe, because 1.5 degrees is good, better for us, already horrible anyway for other countries that suffer now. But it's really about when does it need a consensus? So we can say 1970s, 80s, okay, maybe it was not known that much, but we actually knew. But now we're at a point we have a collective knowledge, and of a lot of things we actually don't know, is it good or not? Like eating meat, we kind of know it's not that good and it's killing beings, but we still can do it because it's part of our culture and because our cervelo here in Switzerland, you know, it's just, yeah, tradition. So we know a lot of things and we don't know it, but we accept it. And I think for me, one part on why this has happened to the point that you also stressed is, I think, is laziness. I think it's really collective cultural laziness, because we're so focused on the ego, we don't see what happens in the eco, and we don't see what it will do to us. So what a lot of indigenous communities in Peru, but also around the world, share is that they have a, they say very clearly, in the country that I come from, in Peru, in the Amazon, they say, you guys just forgot that when you burn down trees, you're burning down yourself. Because you don't feel it. And this is the point where I started to go into how can you step into collective trauma. So I do a lot of workshops on earth emotions, which is a label that Glenn Albrecht, a psychologist from Australia, has labeled. And it's really about, we know collective traumas from the Second World War, but we also know it now basically that we have this earth emotions, which can be positive or negative, that we actually are feeling, but we cannot recognize it. For activists, we say it's when you're in action that you feel all of them. It can be, you know, that you feel paralyzed or you feel empowered, you're dreaming, but you feel this collective power and you feel that you're doing it because our home planet is being destroyed. It's turning into an inhabitable space. It's not being destroyed, but being inhabitable. And I think there is where we need to, in my view, we need to find courage. Art needs to find courage. A society needs to find courage. Scientists finally are finding courage. You know, so it's really bankers need to find courage. People need to collectively leave Shell and Vitol and all these other demons, you know. If that happens, if we find courage and we share it together and we step into it together, we can change it. Because if we're always doing it by ourselves, alone, it will happen what you read in the text. People will suffer, they get scared, they feel lost, they will never do it again. And they look from afar. So my question is also, what kind of spaces do we have to create so the mass, I would say it, but it can be, you know, within the arts bubble or it can be within CEOs. I mean, I also already went to University of St. Gallen and spoke to this alumnus and a lot of them CEOs and rich people. And it's what do you need to tell them actually? Is it really the catastrophe? Or is it also bringing in visions, bringing in futures? Like the saying that I said in the call was, rewild your imagination to rewild the planet. So we know that from this chaotic, complex system, we need new ideas and new approaches. And I think the very first approach that we need here in Europe, in Switzerland, is we need to be courageous to step into collective empowerment, to leave my own journey or my own career as something that's not urgent. And it's very difficult because we now live in a time where this is still from the old world, it's still dominant. It's still dominating our fears, our dreams, but it's on us also to rewrite the story. And if we just don't give that power anymore, and we say, you know what, I feel myself fully if I can help others to be their full self, we are starting to change the narrative. And so I'm playing around with courageous vulnerability and radical truthfulness since this year. And I'm just trying to find out personally, but also in all the things I do, is, you know, where can I just do this step one? And sometimes, you know, it comes to your face back and then just stand up and go on.
I love that you mentioned the emotions that come with climate crisis, and that you before said that movement helps you, because for me that's exactly that thing. You talked about feeling paralyzed when we have that fear, and not only does direct movement from our body help against being paralyzed, but also does a social movement, being part of a social movement, help me with my climate anxiety. So instead of feeling like I don't have any power and I can't do anything, as you mentioned, movement can, collective movement especially, can really bring back that positive feelings.
I think we are about to design a nice project here. But I also think that this embodiment of a certain feeling you have at the moment, it also helps to not feel alone, like what you said in this text, because there, the narrative always tells us to be afraid, to be responsible all alone, and I have to do something. And then you stop immediately because I think it doesn't help anyway when I myself do something. And I believe in a certain ripple effect also, that we are not afraid of just start somewhere, and then maybe you convince five more, and the five more, five times five more. and that we are not afraid of just starting and really this mind shift. I'm stuck there also a bit, how to get this done, because the narrative of, oh, you will lose something if you don't buy so many clothes again, or if you don't eat meat again, or if you don't fly again anymore, then that's always kind of a loser system somehow. And I think we need narratives that tell us that degrowth is great and super, and we gain something. And this, how to shift this, I think that's a challenge, really.
Yeah, but I have really the feeling that we tell ourselves that we're free and we need to be more courageous and we're too lazy, whereas I think we're not free. And we are very courageous sometimes, and we're very much entangled. And this is where we should look to, actually. So the narrative is a complete other one. We have often, as to climate change, this thing of, people don't do anything because they can't think long term. And we know, of course, climate change is this progressive and change of the climate. But I don't agree with that. Precisely, people, if they could, they would be very happy to have stability for themselves through until retirement, for their kids and so on. That their houses take value, that their retirement money is guaranteed and so on. So what it is that prevent us from thinking long-term, etc. This is capitalism, in my understanding. So the problem is that the story that we tell about ourselves is a wrong one, and I will get back to that, artistic freedom, but not even the freedom to speak out within a project about a problem with the choreographer or with a colleague. Doesn't have to be always this low-up thing. Huh? I think it's very going in very different directions. So I think that as long as we think of ourselves as free and just lacking the courage, just lacking the responsibility, probably we're also wrong, because for me, this is precisely the problem. That is, this is this view of human nature. And for me, the center and the core problem is not climate change, is what we think of ourselves and how we perceive ourselves. And so the problem is not technical. It's not that we can't do something as a society. It is because I think I can't do anything. I think that in this round we won't be able to do anything. And I think the whole society won't be able to do anything. And this is called low sense of self and collective efficacy. And this is our main problem. So what we need to change, or what we need to do, is not save the world. We need to change our view of ourselves as individual and as collective. And people have a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage to have kids, to have a job, to change up, to have less stability, and to start and have a space to think about climate change. And perhaps you have two jobs, perhaps you're precarious, and I will go back to that. Artists perhaps have not the possibility, or think of themselves as free because they are not, and this is linked to the precarious condition in which they work, this project-based system, this insecurity, and so on. So we really want to now totally change narrative and start to say we are cooperative, we are courageous, we are willing, each and every one of us, on different scales, as to our possibilities. What is it that is preventing us? CEOs are very much also entangled, and they are not free. They are entangled also very much, and this is not to excuse them either.
Can I react?
I agree, I think, on the content, but I have another perspective on why I would say it free, because, yes, here in Switzerland, I'm way freer in my activism than when I'm in Peru. So I am free. So I think we're talking
much more to lose.
Yeah, but it's a other way of, I think, looking at it. I agree we're entangled, and I agree. I personally always talk about a constructed freedom. So people think it's actually our choice. Do we act now or not? here, because we can vote four times. I mean, even in Germany, they cannot do that, right? Four times a year. So we can vote here, and I think the freedom narrative in Switzerland with it's my choice, I have the right, do I want to have a car, or should it be oil-based or electric, or should I just take my bike? It's my freedom, what I want to use. I mean, the retailers use it, everyone uses this narrative, and that's what I was referring to. But in that, we're entangled, so that's why it's a constructed freedom that we think we have it, but we're actually incarcerated. So I would agree on that level. But still comparing it to the global scale, it's also the question, how much time do we have to maintain in this understanding of, yes, we're courageous to live the life we have lived and that past generations have lived, and where do we have to go beyond that? So the courage I'm relating to, even to me as an activist, as a scientist, I'm saying, where do I have to challenge myself still? I could also say, you know what, I did so much, you know, I was imprisoned. But it's not about that, because it's not about ego. It should be about eco, about understanding as part of it and saying, even though we are already courageous, we're not doing enough. Because otherwise we wouldn't have the crisis that we still have oil licenses hanging and still our Swiss banks, you know, being able to invest there, which is linked to our money and our pension, etc. So for me, it has to do there, where do we have a collective responsibility where our personal freedom, the constructive freedom that we perceive as I am free, needs to be limited so we can step into collective action. And there it comes into making those that are in power responsible for the actions, because even going to the streets, you cannot change just the portfolio of a bank. But if we're in masses, it's at some point will get undeniable that they have to change something. So it's not about you changing it just yourself, or by being courageous you can change the narrative, but it means of putting your personal freedom or whatever you perceive as that a bit backwards to step in the collective responsibility to say, even though I'm not yet affected and our country is not affected, I'm aware of the role of our country, and I think something should happen. So there I feel we have more freedom than countries like Peru or like Pakistan that was flooded. I mean, there it's just about surviving, getting your loved ones out and finding out who is alive, who is dead. Mm-hmm. So we have another freedom because we have it already just discussing here. So I was just linking, I feel, to another level, and I'm not... I agree that in that freedom, due to the system that we live in, as we started also, we're definitely part also captured.
Yeah, it's so good because we're not talking really about beliefs, which is the idea of this evening. It's also linking to your contribution, because we think about what kind of beliefs are in the art institutions or inside artworks, and we don't speak about that. Oh, this is like a theoretical thought and a theoretical conversation in a way, but this theoretical conversation doesn't happen in an anywhere. It's happening inside an art institution that is very much about the body. So I would love to link this kind of reflection on belief, reflection on concepts and thoughts back to the body, because we're speaking here in the Tanzhaus Zürich, which is an institution that is about dance. And I would love to ask you, what is the role of the body, or how the body is linked or could be linked to this reflection of belief and this reflection of thinking? Oh, there's already.
Go ahead. So my name is Maureen, and I was just already thinking how I want to bring in again the idea of the body. Mm-hmm. Because I think what is even the problem before, like the individualism and capitalism, is the problem of this separateness of separateness in general, and the separateness between mind and body, and that we started to think of ourselves as our thoughts and as our minds, and became this very rational society. And at the moment I'm researching a lot on the topic of ecosomatics. So how can we use the somatic experience of our body to what you said also, to connect again to that our inner nature is like a continuum with the outer nature. And for me the question came up, how can art transport this? Like I see a lot of possibilities in creating workshops, like bringing really people like interacting with people or bringing them to experience it. So at the moment, I'm really thinking, like, for example, a dance piece. What kind of dance piece? How can it really engage people and not only have them as passive observers from the outside? So that's where I, I wanted to bring it.
Plus one. I totally agree. I mean, this is really what we try to implement more and more, that we believe that skills, dance and choreographic skills, have an impact on society, that we have to bring them outside and to use them and to diversify kind of our profession also of a dancer and a choreographer. And related to climate activism, I really think that there we go. I mean, that we are dancing in the streets for something, for an idea, for an ideology, for a philosophy, and we are doing this together. You can already very much feel it by doing it, that I really mean this, and I need to do this, and you don't question yourself anymore, and you are courageous then, and you are... You don't even think about it. It's just so natural. It just has to be. And I think that's exactly where it should go. It just, it's not a question anymore. Everybody, each morning, goes outside fighting for these ideas and for whatever it needs now to save the planet. And that we do this together and embody this message somehow, because that gives a huge energy, I think, and it is a reconnection again with something we lost over the last centuries or even more. That and of course, in other contexts, it's much more there. We can also learn from other contexts or people, but definitely in this Western society, sitting 8 hours in front of a computer, I'm sorry, I mean, we totally lost track there. And I was just wondering, maybe we need to prove that.
Yeah, we should, isn't it?
Yeah,
thank you.
I mean, maybe we are at Tansa, so maybe just try to do this now together. If you're facing change or if you're experiencing change here and now, how do you embody that? How does it look when you engage in change right now? What could that be? I mean, just go wild. Wow. Well, that was a start, at least. Woo! Thank you for diving into this experiment, really.
Yeah, I think in a way this was a really good example to why the arts are so good and strong, because we had a music that really colored the whole room. And I think that's what the artists and the activists and basically everybody has to do now. We need to color the conversations that we are having in a way that, yeah, but where the focus goes to what we need to do. Art is so manipulative and it's amazing. So, and I think we need to harness that and own it and use it. What is the temperature, the mood in which we live our lives in the next 20, 30, 40, maybe more years? That was just my thought.
Maybe to add, we also had that discussion in climate activism about the positive and negative narrative and how that works psychologically. Because as you mentioned, it doesn't always work very well if you're saying, okay, we're against that and we shouldn't do that. So that's why, for example, in summer there was a climate camp or a resistance camp. And there the slogan was, another world is possible. To make sure that we're talking about what we want for the future and not only what we don't want anymore. And I think that's beautiful to keep in mind when it comes to activism and art, of course.
Empowerment is about the future. If you don't have a sense that you can project yourself in the future, you are disempowered. So indeed, somehow, sometimes, or the problem, I would say, is not the IPCC per se, but sometimes the predictions are received as the confirmation that there is only one future. And this is per se disempowering, and this has been proven also in psychological science, psychology.
Yeah, I just want to add and agree, because I think this is also what one in climate activism, but in general, I feel in activism in all ways, I mean, even in the democracy movements, right, we're starting to say, hey, we can actually rethink democracy. We can even make it more inclusive and stronger. Or, I mean, in feminism, I'm a bit active in ecofeminism movement in Bern, and also there, it's also about how do we evolve? So I feel this dreaming, or this, you know, it has to do with letting go and making space for new things. As you said, I mean, it's how our body anyway works, right? Our cells are renewed every 7 years. We're basically, biologically speaking, a completely different person. And not even our mom knows us, if we look on that level. And I think there it's also, I agree that I see that art has there this huge potential to bring the mass to overcome that. We cannot imagine it without it. Like, we cannot imagine cities without cars. We have seen it in paintings, but I feel most people are like, if you ask them in their daily life rooted with their daily topics in their head, it's just not there yet. And I feel there we have these seeds that can be spread. Like, I see art as a potential, as seed bombs, you know, where we just, some will speak to those, some will speak to those, but it's actually an invitation that it's not one future that we have to talk about and that it has to be coherent, but that we can create it together. And I think there it's also the role of others, and art can also be part of that role, but I also wouldn't see it as main topic to say who is hindering us. So who is actually right now profiting from maintaining the status quo, and how can we change it? So I feel there are like these different parts and different roles and actors in that. But I feel the wider society is really needed to start to dream. And with these dreams, they will not want to have certain things anymore, because they themselves realize it's hindering me in building these new stories. And what I find just really interesting is that with people like you as well, but also younger than you that I've met in the last few years, I really just realize being 33 now, like this generation is already again way ahead of what my generation is, what generations of my friends in their 40s, in their 50s is. And this is so incredible, because this dynamic of just trying out certain things while people in my age already is like, okay, we kind of have this still this old narrative, but we're already in the new one. So I also just want to invite to always, you know, have this look throughout the age ranges and all the different areas, the people, I mean, Christmas coming up, so it's a good moment to just, you know, try to be empathetic, to be empathetic with that, and just see, okay, what are actually the shoes and the perspective that you're in? What is it actually? Because we so often assume, because we know them for a long time, but we actually don't know. And I think there is a huge power as well of just seeing, okay, how could I actually speak to you? So we maybe find a new story we can draw together.
Yeah. Oh, you would also want to add something?
Yeah.
There's a mic, I think.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring in a little critical thought on what you just said. I totally agree that art has the potential to do that, but I'm asking, do artists have the potential to do that? Because, and then I come back what you said before, it's like, as an artist, I'm coming from the field of the fine arts, but I'm not an artist. I work as an art mediator, curator. And but then you're part of a system. And like, if you, we were talking in the beginning of the concept of autonomy, it's a concept, as our autonomous art is a concept that comes very much from the fine arts, I think.
And she said she didn't want to do it, so I didn't ask her, but now I'm happy that she still wants.
No, and then it's like, also the narrative goes like, okay, there were the queens, the kings, the church, that were the commissioners, and art was not free. was not autonomous. And then all of a sudden, a bit more than 200 years ago, it became autonomous. But it's not true, because the art market replaced the others. And the art market was looking for artists that do whatever they want, and they're genius and work by themselves. So this is also part of the concept. So I'm not sure if this narrative of the autonomy of art is really so about free, being free. And so I'm just saying, the art has the potential, you say, if you work with artistic means, then it can add also to activism. But I'm not sure if you have really, like, that's why also maybe the artists don't gather, because we are still part of the system and we have to survive. You have to be in an institution, you have to show your stuff, you have to go on a residency. So this is a bit the thing you meant, I think, by being entangled or something, like, or?
Yeah, but I would then add, not only perhaps aren't we free as artists, or I'm not an artist now, but as artists or as humans, as much as we think, because we are so much entangled. But also on the same level, on the same line, I would say it is not about art saving the world. It is about art transforming itself. Then I'm going to be very disappointing, perhaps, but I think I hope not. I think also that utopia is a bit of a problem. The dreams, there's a great sociologist that was, I'm just saying a few words, but she was saying the dream of our grandparents are our climate change, our asbestos and all the kind of problems that we have. There's another future researcher who says, just as we wouldn't like the values, as we don't like the values of the generation of our grandparents to influence today, we shouldn't today try to determine the values for the next generation. And I also say, the utopia, let's say as an example, for women to be in leadership position is not as empowering than, let's say, the possibility for women and for men and for everyone in general to be whatever they want. A deeper empowerment arises from reopening the horizon and not having one precise utopia of what should happen. I would say with the great lady staying with the trouble. Donna Haraway. So beware of utopias, because these are the next ideologies. I've said, what is an ideology which is not an ideology? And that would be, for me, the willingness and the wish to reopen the horizon of the future in many different directions, but never today trying to colonize the future and say what should be tomorrow. That's very important.
Yeah. But don't you think they're exactly art and artists, I hope they agree, could be a motor to imagine futures we don't even think about now? I'm not talking about utopias. I'm talking about that art or artists have skills to imagine and embody possible futures. And there I see, and that's really, because this is still talking in this system, that there is a system, a capitalistic freedom, let's say, or call it. It's still with kind of the system here, and I'm longing for something that we could together imagine, and with many voices and many bodies, as I said before, so it's not one unique possibility.
Indeed, that would be the speculative. That's the idea precising of reopening the horizon of the future. If I'm convinced that there's only climate catastrophe, I will find proofs of my beliefs in reality, and I won't do anything. And if we are all convinced that there's only a climate catastrophe, we have more chances to get there. This is called a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is the performativity of the future in the present, and then the fact that we land there. So indeed, precisely, we should never think that there's only one future. Should it be an utopia or dystopia? Because we will have more chance to get there, and we won't see other opportunities for other different futures. Voilà. So it's exactly what you said, speculating many different futures, and I think very much that the artists have this capacity.
I have to come back because it made me also think of one way that I have been working lately, which is a lot connected to... So I've been working a lot with improvisation, so I don't give my dancers clear instructions, but I lead them through certain processes. And I do this often or most of the times by putting them into settings, so spatial settings, material settings. And for me, it has developed, or I realized lately that it actually feels like field research somehow. So I put human beings, human bodies in certain settings, and I watch. This is the biggest part of my choreographic work. I watch how these bodies react. And in this way, it can also be like not even thinking of utopias or dystopias, but different settings. What happens to us? I think this is also a chance, like of we don't need to actually live these 50 years until a certain setting is created or not. And then we can't have like 150 different settings at the same time. But we can have them like here and now and experience how the human body reacts in it. And that's one potential of dance specifically.
Yeah.
Also, just quickly, thank you so much for mentioning that also, like to be in the system as a professional artist. Because I also feel like, coming back to the A1 choreography, it's always things like, I've been speaking to many people that have like, jobs outside of the cultural sectors and that can afford to like work 40% or whatever and do activism besides. And to be honest, as an artist, I can't afford that. So it has to be connected somehow.
Thank you for saying it, for having the courage of saying it.
For me, it's just also to getting back to building on that, but also want to share another point. For me, that's clear. So I also co-created Music Declares Emergency 3 years ago, and the music industry has the exact same problem. So it is definitely a thing, but it is also a thing in science. I mean, I left science out of decision. So I think that's clear, and I was really referring to the material kind of way of expression that can create like the pathways where people can start to dream, to have the variety. So I also agree on that point. What I really liked with the last input you shared is I also do kind of social transformation dialogues, and I work a lot with CRU from Otto Scharmer, from the Presencing Institute. And with him, I had a long discussion in the context of a space we are sharing together, which is the World Ethic Forum. And it's really about like dreaming, how can we... It's not about saying where to bring people or what has to happen or what action has to happen, but... really this, what spaces do we create so people get to the emerging, right? So you don't know what will emerge, but you also will not tell them just it's bad what you have. So they themselves go to the journey to deconstruct and see, okay, what happens if I open my mind, if I open my heart, and in the end I get to the point where I actually open my will to question myself, to see what comes after. And what you shared, it reminded me a lot of the work where I'm doing exactly that on facilitation. How do you create spaces where people actually themselves get to the point to say, yes, let's prototype, let's try it out, and let's redo it. And I feel this is the time we're in. That's so for me, this has nothing to do with the future. It has to do with right here, right now, because if we keep on doing just as we have done, because we're in a system, because we have things, I'm asking just where do we have certain spaces where we could try out new things, do new connections. And there is, for me, the courage part, right?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm just going to stop here for a second and perhaps encourage everyone to want to speak about that later on the bar, because now we, I think, kind of stressing the time frame a bit too much, but I never imagined how far we journey like together in this this question, which is so great. And I'm very happy that you brought in the end the question of freedom again inside, which is very important. And besides like the talk, I wanted to ask what is the role of the art institution within this talk, I think we just answered these questions by sitting here together and bringing people and bodies together and having almost a kind of speaking therapy, which is perhaps the role of the art institution, to providing a space and providing a room and the possibility to talk and exchange. And I'm very, very happy for each of you for your contributions and the sharing of your thoughts. And I'm very happy that we had the chance to encounter here and encounter the ideas, and I encourage everyone to who wants to go ahead with this discussion later on at the bar or wherever. Perhaps really to not break it like here, if anyone wants to add like a final sentence, I would be more than happy to encourage you for that, but a very short one perhaps.
Go off,
so. And Lena, you also wanted to say something.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I really like what you said about staying with the trouble. So we cannot solve this issue tonight. The climate crisis is something that will demand a lot of work, and it will not stop. And it's important to talk about the potentials, but also the conflicts, and stay with them, stay with the trouble. So we will need more places, more platforms, more spaces to talk. And that's also why it's an open talk, because we hope that this will continue.
Can we do a round of closing remarks for those of us who want to do them?
Yeah.
I just want to add, staying with the trouble means that there's nothing that is right. So it's not only about relocalization. It's not about relocalization is not right per se. Reducing CO2 emissions is not right per se. Veganism is not right per se, et cetera, and everything. And this is staying with the trouble because it gets much harder.
Since we're going to do a round, I don't feel the pressure of trying to be super short. So first of all, it's amazing to be here, right? I think it's a great tradition of people getting together and exchanging ideas, and no one's paying us, so it's fantastic. So once again, thank you so much for the hosting and the organization. Amazing. Recently, or 2 years ago, I was at the university, and we were doing this course between environmental science at ETH and also systems thinking and design thinking, and trying to figure out how to come up with new ways to target climate change. And our proposed solution was to play a game. So we created a series of games. But the reason for that was because people are in a much more open way to change and challenge their positions about the views of the world and their current consumption landscape and so on. So maybe that's something, right? So our paper led to the creation of a game, which, by the way, if you meet me at the bar, I can tell you more about it. It's called Greta und die vier Reiter. So I think that art really, truly does have a role to play. And one of the key insights why I say that is because traditionally, when you think of new products, you try to divide your audience into, I don't know, economic levels or social levels or education. But one of the insights we had was that you might have a very highly paid lawyer, right? A very expensively educated, highly paid, having the same opinion towards climate change as someone working in a hairdressing saloon. So we really have to come up with new ways to approach people. And art, I think, is a great way of doing so. So once again, thank you very much, and keep doing the great work.
Yes, I wanted to share that I'm always very surprised that as a human you need to get to a catastrophe or a breaking down or an accident to shift your perspective and have the invitation to find another way of thinking or another way to act. And then we always like somehow react on what was happening, but not really act on prevention it. And this come back to the time idea. And I wanted to maybe invite us like to take 1 minute a day to close the eyes and to just take a time to breathe and to connect with our heart, to feel our body, and to start to be more aware of our body, and then maybe to extend it as an individual to the collective, the one body.
And I will add to that, thank you very much for including the body.
That when all these bodies, like the change starts with me and with you and with you and with you. And if I change my inner structure, my neural system, my patterns, I start a change in society. And this can be through breathing 1 minute a day. And so we all have power.
Yeah. Does someone else around want to add something as well from you?
I can just share one thought. I am personally super privileged. I'm super lazy. I refer to the laziness. And I really hope that the artists help me because I have problems to think the unthinkable. And there, the artist, that's their kind of speciality. Regardless in which field they are actually working, they start always from the scratch somehow. And this is a very empowering thing to witness. And this is what I need to get maybe out of my laziness, because I'm super busy in my daily life and I forget many things. And if I think about climate change, the first thing is guilt and comes up. And I need somehow help there that the artist help me to share their vision of the unthinkable, because that's their speciality. I'm too busy with my consumption every day and I'm lazy, and there I need really there I see a potential for the art.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks to everyone and for taking the place, and what I always say to activists when I do nonviolent direct action trainings, and I would just like to share it with you but with anyone who can take it along, if you're in the guilt or in the fear or in rage, just pause and breathe and think of all the things you actually love on this beautiful planet we call home, right? And if you then feel in love, then step into action. So I always say, don't step into action in rage. Step into it when you're connected with your heart. And then also, you know, step into art and step into writing me a mail so we can think of something together. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Das war es also, das sehr lange Gespräch im Tanzhaus Zürich mit Katja Löpfe, Leiterin des Tanzhaus Zürich, mit Alexandra Gavilano, Umweltwissenschaftlerin und Klimaaktivistin, mit Isabel Wong, Kulturmanagerin, Kuratorin und Zukunftsforscherin und mit Lina Hasenfratz, Schauspielerin und Klimaaktivistin. Moderiert wurde das Ganze von Charlotte Mattheisen, von Lena Schubert und von Johann Otten.
Ja, und ich hoffe, ihr seid alle noch da. Ich selber habe auf jeden Fall auch beim zweiten Mal sehr gerne zugehört. Und mir ist geblieben, dass wir hier eigentlich eine ganz grundsätzliche Diskussion geführt haben oder bei einer sehr grundsätzlichen Diskussion dabei waren. Nämlich es ging bei dem Ganzen doch um den Übergang von einem Zeitalter ins andere. Das Zeitalter, wo wir jetzt drinstecken, ist eigentlich das Zeitalter der totalen Freiheit, wo eben auch in den Künsten, überhaupt im Leben, in allem, was wir tun, eigentlich das Prinzip Freiheit an oberster Stelle steht. Und ich glaube, wir gehen in ein neues Zeitalter hinein, in ein Zeitalter der Verantwortung gegenüber der Natur, gegenüber dem Klima, gegenüber unserem Planeten ganz allgemein. Und was das heißt, auch für die Künste, das wurde hier diskutiert, aber ich glaube eben, es ging noch über das hinaus. Also es hat mich alles natürlich sehr an dieses Buch von Hans Jonas, das Prinzip Verantwortung, erinnert.
Jan, Sie sprechen ja auch davon, wie das zwischen verschiedenen Generationen Unterschiede gibt, wie der Zugang zu dieser Verantwortung, zu der Klimakrise allgemein ist. Ich finde, das war ein sehr spannender Teil der Diskussion. Sonst geblieben ist mir auch das Verständnis von Kunst als eine andere Sprache, als ein anderer Zugang, den man
zu Leuten entwickeln kann, als etwas, was vielleicht weniger an die Vernunft appelliert und mehr an Gefühle appelliert. Ich finde das, ich fand das interessant zu hören, wie Sie davon gesprochen haben, was für Sie Kunst ist und was Kunst kann.
Und das sind ja doch die einen oder anderen interessanten Projekte und Ideen dann eben auch aufgeploppt. Mir ist geblieben eben diese Idee, ein Ballett auf der A1 aufzuführen, also die A1, die Autobahn sozusagen zu besetzen mit einem Ballett, und auch andere Projekte zeigen eben, dass in der Kunst natürlich eine Sprengkraft liegt, die in anderen Bereichen der Gesellschaft vielleicht eben nicht vorhanden sind. Und dieses Potenzial zu schöpfen, wie das geschöpft werden kann, ich glaube nicht, dass da eine Lösung jetzt präsentiert wurde in dieser Diskussion, aber ich fand es anregend, da zuzuhören. Das Problem, über das dann ein bisschen zu wenig gesprochen wurde, aber das natürlich im Raum steht, ist, kann hier irgendjemand in die Pflicht genommen werden? Also gibt es eine Verpflichtung der Künste, sich jetzt diesem Thema zuzuwenden, so wie wir sagen würden an einem geologischen oder geografischen Institut einer Universität, gibt es diese Verpflichtung? Also können wir angesichts der Krise, in der wir stecken, in dieser Klimakrise, in der wir stecken, wirklich auch eine Verpflichtung zur Übernahme dieser Verantwortung ableiten? Und da sind wir natürlich in einer ganz fundamentalen Demokratiediskussion.
Ja, das ist auch eine Frage, die offen blieb in der Diskussion und über die man sich jetzt weiter Gedanken machen kann.
Über diese Tage gibt es Zeit, sich darüber Gedanken zu machen. Und damit sind wir am Ende dieser absolut längsten Episode von Treibhaus, dem Klimapodcast.
Nächstes Mal dann wieder in der gewohnten Länge.
Allerdings bleiben wir bei einem ähnlichen Fokus wie in dieser Ausgabe. Wir fragen nämlich, wie und wo die Klimakrise in der Literatur vorkommt. Und wir machen eine Zeitreise von Charles Ferdinand Ramu bis zu Karen Duwe. Wir machen also eine Zeitreise in der Literatur und in der Klimadiskussion in der Literatur.
Ja, und wir sprechen dazu unter anderem mit den Verantwortlichen des Zürcher Strauhofs, wo gerade eben eine Ausstellung zum Thema läuft. Schaut euch diese Ausstellung noch an, wenn ihr könnt. Es sind die letzten Tage.
Bevor wir enden in dieser Episode, noch dieser Aufruf, den ihr schon kennt, aber der deshalb nicht weniger wichtig ist, der Aufruf, uns zu unterstützen.
Auf unserer Webseite mit dem Button unterstützen.
Geht auf die Webseite, klickt auf den Button unterstützen, und wenn es beim ersten Mal nicht klappt, macht ein Reload und dann funktioniert es. Wir danken sehr.
Treibhaus, der Klimapodcast. Eine Produktion von Podcast Lab mit Lena Schubert, Johann Otten, Samuel Schläfli, Olivier Christe, Anna Fierz, mit der Musik von Lukas Fretz und mit Selin Elber und Christoph Keller.
Treibhaus ist zu finden auf unserer Webseite www.treibhauspodcast.ch, auf Spotify, auf Apple Podcasts und auf allen guten Podcast-Kanälen. Wenn euch dieser Podcast gefällt, wenn ihr Anregungen habt, wie immer Kritik und Ideen, dann schreibt uns auf Facebook oder per Mail an mail@treibhauspodcast.ch, und wenn ihr mögt, schaut auf Instagram vorbei.